Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the Mobility is a Method series. The series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobility is a Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobility is a Methods Lab and New Books Network partnership provides a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. My name is Aliza Arıcan. Today, I'm joined by Colin McFarlane, Professor of Urban Geography at Durham University, UK. We will be talking about his book, Fragments of the City, Making and Remaking Urban Worlds, published by the University of California Press in 2021. Thank you very much, Colin, for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Of course. So at the New Books Network, we usually start our episodes by getting to know our authors a little bit better. So can you tell us about your background as a geographer and how you came to urban geography?
Sure. Well, firstly, thanks for the invitation for doing this. I'm looking forward to the conversation. So my own background, it's always really fascinating to hear how people get into this business and how people became geographers. It's a fascinating question I like to ask people myself. I guess for me personally, I always cared about cities and particularly sort of urban inequalities. You know, we grew up in a fairly kind of low-income neighbourhood in South Glasgow, and I was sort of acutely aware, really, from the age of a child onwards, to the kind of questions of poverty and inequality that were structuring the city, right? And to how cities were lived, what they offer, what they don't offer, how they're differently experienced. I was sort of fascinated and drawn to that stuff really early on. So that's partly where it came from. And then I did, at university, Glasgow University, I did urban geography in my second year. It's a module that you could choose, led by Ronan Patterson, and in that wonderful geography department at Glasgow University. I got very interested and, you know, drawn to some of the questions urban geography was asking of the city around me, the city I grew up in and I was still living in as a student. I found it very kind of practical and political and energizing to think through the city from a geographical perspective. And then my PhD, I sort of went on to focus on cities, actually not in the UK, but in India. So I kind of started to look at Indian cities, and in particular, I became very interested in Mumbai. And that was the focus of my PhD, was Mumbai, and also my postdoc. And again, a lot of the same questions, urban inequalities, urban experience, how urban life was differently lived. A lot of those issues and questions that were really with me from a young age, still there in the PhD. But what was interesting was that geography, Glasgow, I learned about urban geography, but I also learned about India. So I was able to kind of think, well, you know, I've got these questions about cities that I'm interested in, but I could do it anywhere if I'm lucky enough to get the PhD funding. And I was fortunate to get PhD funding actually at Durham University, where I am at the moment. And that was a real kind of eye-opener and a fantastic experience. So that's how it started for me.
That's very fortunate for us, your readers, as well. But I love how you took us through this long-term thinking about cities. And your book really reads as this long-term thinking, moving, and writing. So I was wondering if you could also tell us how you came to the book and how did you arrive at Fragments?
Well, you're right that the book brings together thinking and research that I've done across quite a long period of time. So I was just saying earlier that my work was focused on Mumbai as a PhD student, but I guess over the what's now been 15 years or so since I finished my PhD, I've become involved in research projects in other cities in different parts of the world, many of which feature in the book. So, for example, in the book I talk about Mumbai, but I also talk about Berlin, Hong Kong, Kampala, Cape Town, a few other cities in different parts of the book. So in the process of writing, I became, I guess over the years, looking at these different cities, I became increasingly interested in, you know, I guess like a lot of urbanists actually recently, over the past couple of decades, really interested in the question of global urbanism, right? So it was partly, so my sort of arrival at the question of Fragments really began with the question of global urbanism. And my initial question, which when I think about it, I was thinking about this morning in preparation for this conversation, my initial question was really around trying to conceptualize and think about researching global urbanism, right? And that was, I think that really started in earnest back in 2014, so that's about 8 years ago. And I was starting to see the work that I was doing in different cities as very often both about fragments, right? So about fragments of infrastructure, fragments of housing, or even fragments of knowledge, but also as taking the form of fragments, by which I mean, you know, the work I was doing were some very particular encounters and stories of urban conditions in different times and different places. So I started to see both the content and the style of the work I was doing as kind of captured by this notion of fragments. So rather than trying to distill all those stories that I was picking up from different research projects into one kind of meta-narrative that sought to kind of explain or describe global urbanism, I began to wonder, I suppose, whether it might be more valuable for me, at least, to kind of stick with the fragments, right? To kind of keep a hold of that kind of more, I guess, more messy picture of so many different fragments. And so that's really where I started to think about the book. And that was probably 2014-15.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And like throughout the book, as you think about fragment urbanism, you emphasize that fragments are relational, right? And I found that so compelling. So I was wondering if you could tell us about what relationality does for you in this work and what is at stake in thinking about urban fragments relationally?
Yeah, it's a really good question because relationality is central to the story I tell about fragments in the book. And I suppose, in particular, the relationship between relationality and practice of different kinds. Yeah. So I'll maybe say a few things about that. Mindful too of the fact that relationality of different kinds has become sort of fundamental to how we think about cities in urban studies and geography. It's a much more general debate to be had around the presence of relational thinking in different parts of urban work. For me, fragments are both the products of all kinds of processes and histories, right? And entities in and of themselves. So both products and entities. And these entities may be material bits and pieces, you know, broken toilets or discarded bits of junk in the city, for instance, or forms of knowledge and ways of knowing the city that are often sort of marginalized or unseen by the more powerful actors in the city. But these entities are made and remade in all kinds of ways and for all sorts of reasons. So they're pulled into different kinds of relations all the time. You know, they might become used in a protest, for example, or in the campaign of a social movement, or they may become pieces of art, or they may become vital to sort of everyday survival, right? So they're used in all these different ways all the time, and they might take on different meanings to different groups, right? Interpreted differently, seen from different angles of vision, and so on. So fragments are both historical products and these entities that feature as sites of potential, right? Sites of potential that are made through different relations and practices in the city. So that's why in the book I talk about them as both nouns and verbs, fragments as both nouns and verbs. This isn't to say that, you know, there aren't sort of real limits on the possibilities of making fragments anew. You know, the book deals, you know, I think it's important to say that the book deals with people in places that are sort of heavily marginalized and excluded, living on the margins of, you know, sometimes really sort of challenging, extremely challenging circumstances. And so, and sometimes it's precisely because of those circumstances that fragments are reinvented for different purposes, right? For example, in a protest, a political protest. But you know, it's important to say that these are nonetheless very prescribed circumstances for most of the places and people that I'm sort of talking about in the book, right? These are residents, really poor living conditions quite often. And it's not like they're simply free to creatively reinvent fragments all the time in these kind of innovative ways. So I don't want to suggest that in a way that sort of undermines the hardships they're living in. In fact, in some places in the book, I try to stress the opposite, which is that, you know, that I try to ask, how do people manage to cope, get by, to get on in the city, even amidst the destruction and debris of all these kind of fragmented urban worlds that I describe? So I guess, yes, relational practices are central to understanding fragments in the book, partly because it gets that sense of fragments being remade as verbs, but under often very prescribed, limited, challenging circumstances. And it's important to keep a hold of that last part when writing about this, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important tension to keep in mind. So thanks so much for drawing our attention to that. And I love how in the book, like, fragments act sort of as an anchor that pushes us to think about other concepts that are closely related, like care and consolidation. And, you know, that part is also one that I found very interesting. So how does fragmented urbanism open up our understandings of care and consolidation?
Right, I'll say something, I suppose, about care and consolidation and how I talk about them in the book. But maybe I'll just start by saying that when people are living in conditions where, you know, the home or the neighbourhood is highly fragmented, right? So where, for example, infrastructures might be breaking down kind of frequently, or housing is constantly demanding this ongoing process of repair, right? In these kinds of conditions, care and consolidation amongst residents can become very important. Amongst all kinds of other processes, right? But the argument I make in the book is that care becomes especially important. So I think about care in two sort of broad ways in the book. One is that there is care for fragments, right? So there is a kind of social work of care to, for example, maintain and repair broken or inadequate pieces of infrastructure or living spaces or public spaces. And as I talk about different examples of that, so this might include sort of the routine work of maintaining mundane infrastructures such as public toilets or community toilets. I talk about how NGOs or community groups are involved in that work, you know, working with local actors to ensure that maintenance takes place. So there's a kind of care for fragments. It's the first sort of form of care that I talk about. And then there's care that emerges, secondly, partly because of fragments and, you know, partly because of living amongst fragmented urbanisms where, you know, residents form social infrastructures, and I talk about social infrastructures quite a lot in the book, to sort of support one another in different ways, right? So this might include residents, for example, training each other to set up small businesses or to find job opportunities or, you know, to access childcare or just looking out for each other, right? You know, watching the kids while people are at work or helping out in terms of a personal crisis, you know, when something goes wrong and so on and so forth, right? So in the book, there's lots of discussions around that based on work that I've done with colleagues in Kampala, for example. And in these cases, the way I describe this is that care operates partly to cope with fragmented urbanisms and partly to help find a way of getting beyond fragmented urbanism, right? So it has that dual kind of function. With consolidation, just quickly, I'll just say consolidation is a slightly different thing. Consolidation is when residents have reached a point in a particular aspect of their lives where, you know, conditions are maybe more stable and predictable. So, you know, that's not the case for most of the residents and most of the places that I'm talking about in the book, you know, whose lives are often very volatile and things are often breaking down and falling apart around them. It's a struggle to kind of make things work and make things predictable. But for some of the residents that I describe, some of the aspects of their lives, maybe housing, maybe infrastructure, maybe income, has become more reliable, stable, and predictable. In those circumstances, those residents are able to sort of almost insulate themselves from some of the fragments that I discuss in the book. And so that's the sense of consolidation that I'm trying to get at there.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. And I love how you bring up, you know, not just presence of, you know, things and relations, but also their absences. And I'm curious about how you think about this tension between presence and absence when you think about fragmented urbanisms.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked about that, because I think it's one of the things I was sort of really most fascinated by in writing the book, is this relationship between presence and absence, which I think is quite an important, sort of powerful, compelling one when it comes to the fragment, the idea of the fragment. So I think there's a really fascinating historical story to be told here, which I only sort of briefly describe in the book, around not just cities but right across history, right? So, you know, we can think about the significance of fragments, you know, in the ancient world or in religion, fragments in archaeology, museums, myth, storytelling, and so on. You know, there's a whole body of work, some of which I describe in the book, but it's kind of on the edges of the book, you know, in sort of material culture, art history, the classics, archaeology, and so on. You know, where basically what struck me across a lot of those literatures was that discussions of the fragment are typically as much about what is not there as they are about what is there, right? It's as much about what is not there as what is there. And so there's work, for example, in archaeology that, as I briefly talk about, which examines what's called deliberate fragmentation. So there's cases in like prehistoric Europe, for instance, where, you know, archaeologists have shown how the fragments of an object get distributed across different people in different places. And those fragments come to stand for a kind of social bond or for a connection to a larger whole. And there's like a really deep history of this around sort of religious relics, and kind of like, it's partly what makes fragments so interesting historically, because their absences, right, you know, become this kind of mysterious, symbolic, important kind of almost like a detective story, right? So where did the, you know, from which holes did these fragments come from, and what did the holes or the fragments come to mean for different people at different times, and so on. So in cities, we can think of this in all kinds of ways. Like there is, for example, the way in which fragments might provoke memories or dreams of distant pasts. So we see this in someone like Orhan Pamuk's writing on Istanbul, where he talks about, you know, the cultural melancholy attached to ruins in Istanbul. And I talk about that briefly in the book. Or we see it in the sort of deeply political meanings attached to ruins or ruined buildings in places like Israel or Palestine, which, you know, here in Durham, Noam Latium, he's written really fascinatingly about that. And of course, like there's like in a more mundane way, there's like a really large tourist industry around sort of visiting urban ruins or relics or remnants of different kind, you know, religious sites, sort of war damaged buildings, or like kind of abandoned spaces, you know, like underground tunnels or unfinished walkways, or, you know, people going to sort of the ruined industrial spaces of Detroit, for example, and taking photographs, you know, all that stuff. There's a whole industry around sort of fragments of different kinds in the urban landscape, which is, again, about this relationship between absence and presence. So in the book, I try to deal with it in all kinds of ways. So, for example, you can think about how a broken toilet block acts as a kind of reminder of what is not there as much as what is there. So the pipes and facilities that are missing, which may even have never been there, right? So there's this kind of sense of a shadow of a hole, an absence that's always kind of like in the present, and can have quite an important impact on people's lives and politics. So I do think you're right. There's a really interesting tension between sort of presence and absence in relation to fragments and how fragments get made and remade over time, over space. And I think that, you know, that's something that would be really productive to think about more in relation to cities more generally. For example, just as a last comment on this, I think Abdelmalek Simon's work is really interesting in relation to this very question. But he talked, for example, about how the city is always slipping away. You know, it's always more than it seems, always forcing new and surprising stories and encounters. And so, and that relationship of presence and absence is quite important there.
Yeah, that is really fascinating. And speaking of presence and absences, I also love how you show that fragments don't operate in a vacuum. And you show us that they often work in tandem with what you call surveying holes. So can you elaborate on what surveying holes means and what kinds of political possibilities do these kinds of co-workings open up?
That's a really interesting question. I think there's a lot that I would want to say there. I won't, because I'll go on and on. But
you're welcome to.
I want to subject you to that answer. Well, in a sense, the whole book is about the politics of fragments in cities. I suppose, as a general point, my argument in the book is sort of not to advocate for one or another form of politics. So across the different cases and cities that I discussed, there are like very different ways of pursuing the politics of fragments, you know, whether it's by residents or artists or activists or social movements or NGOs or whatever, right? And so, you know, I won't sort of list them all, but just a few examples. There's the politics of attending to fragments, which I was kind of just talking about, all that stuff around care and maintenance and so on. And then there's a politics around what I call generative translation, where fragments are sort of translated. They're put into different work to generate new kinds of politics. So, you know, I talk, for instance, about how social movements around sanitation in Cape Town and Mumbai take fragments and make them into political statements by shifting their context and organising protests around them, for instance, right? Or I talk about art and the way in which art sometimes uses, you know, the rubble or the discarded ruins of fragmented buildings or homes in order to stage a political conversation. And I talk about occupation as a way of assembling fragments and resisting fragmentation. So the different cases in the book where I talk about, you know, the politics of fragments. So just there, it was, you know, attending to, generating translation, occupation. I also talk about value and so on. And you know, you mentioned surveying holes in your question, and that's a form of the politics of fragments, which is when activists in the book seek to produce data about particular kinds of holes, right? W-H-O-L-E-S, holes. So I talk, for instance, about how activists in Mumbai produce data sets about the sort of number and the condition of public toilets in the city. You know, so toilets in public spaces, transport stations, neighbourhoods, all kinds of spaces, right? And then they produce that data to try to hold the state accountable and to lobby for resource. So in other words, their politics of fragment urbanism at that point in time is about not so much working with the fragments, but by working with particular kinds of holes, right? W-H-O-L-E-S, that partly produce fragmentation in the first place. And sometimes that's a very effective strategy. But the larger point I try to make in the book, though, about the politics of fragments is that different kinds of politics work in different ways for different people at different times. So that's a politics of fragments, which I think is contingent and contextual. So we can, I think we can learn something from activists who move between different kinds of politics depending on what the moment calls for, right? So I think in academia, we sometimes fall into the trap of thinking that particular political models or approaches are more important or more useful or more successful than others, or that we can't sort of simultaneously use different political approaches. But I think, you know, and I can understand why we think that, because it's often because we want to avoid holding on to seemingly contradictory approaches at the same time, or we want to promote a particular political story, and that's all fine and good. But this is the thing is, this is exactly what activists, I think, often have to do, right? Is use multiple political strategies at different times and different situations, and probably, if we're honest, that's actually what academics often have to do as well. But and I think it's necessary and productive for activists to do that, even though it brings all kinds of risks and challenges and so on. So that's the kind of general pitch I make about the politics of fragments. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I love how you emphasize that, because, you know, the urban worlds we're working with are messy. So, yeah, you know, our ways of dealing with them should also be messy.
I agree. Not everyone would agree with that. You know, some people would say, well, you know, the urban world is messy, therefore we as academics have a job of, you know, telling stories which are much tidier and clearer and simplified. And I totally understand that. But I suppose, like I said right at the start, for me it was kind of what happens when you try to stay with the mess, you know, we try and stick with the fragments a little bit and see what kinds of stories about politics or urban life emerge from that context. But that I totally appreciate and respect that many of my colleagues in different places, you know, wouldn't want to do that. And that's partly what makes urban studies a fun place to work, is that there is a lot of a fun and often argumentative place to work.
Indeed. I love how we spoke about staying with the mess. Now I want to ask you a little bit more on how you stayed with the mess or endeavored to. So, you know, what really stood out to me was how you described the book as an archive of fragments. And even in our conversation, you mentioned that you stitched together art, literature, fieldwork, even memoir and visuals to generate this kind of archive. So was generating an archive a methodological tool for you? And how does this book in particular expand our understanding of what an archive is?
Yeah, that's such a fascinating question. I'll try and answer. I mean,
your book generates it.
it's interesting. I hope I'll. I mean, I guess I use the term archive really just to stress that the book is a kind of collection of fragments itself, right? It's a kind of shorthand in that sense. So, you know, the book is written as short fragments of text from different places that hopefully, you know, resonate with one another and provide some insight into urban life today. But I like the phrase you just used, you know, stitch together when you were talking, because that, I suppose that's exactly right. This effort to try to find linkages and resonances across different stories and forms, you know, fieldwork, art, literature, and so on. So as a methodology, right, so I've not thought a huge amount about that. As a methodology, I think this work of stitching together is sort of inevitably a kind of experimental one, where you're sort of feeling your way along. So, you know, you're trying to find connections between cases. So some of the discussions in the book are based on research projects or research activities where I was specifically sort of on the lookout for fragments, if you like, you know, of different kinds. You know, I sort of went out to find fragments and had particular questions to ask about them. But other discussions in the book were much more sort of happenstance, sort of things that I kind of came across by chance or maybe that someone recommended. Or perhaps I was looking back sometimes on work that I'd already done and realizing, you know, that fragments were actually an important part of the story, and maybe, you know, I hadn't really noticed that before. So it's experimental then in that sense of trying to weave connections between disparate things in context. But it was also experimental because I was trying to write the book in fragments, right? In fragments of text, so that I could, in a sense, underscore the content of the book through the form of the book, right? And that was definitely something I wanted to try and experiment with, and I made my mind up about doing early on in the writing process. Well, I say made my mind up. I went back and forth on it quite a lot and then eventually decided, no, I'm going to try and do this. Having tried it, abandoned it, tried it again. So it was not straightforward. It's very easy to look back on things and say, yeah, this is how I did it, and it was all very well thought through and strategic, and actually it was months of agonizing pain and going back and forth on it. But the question I continually faced was, like, as I was writing, was how should I connect these different fragments of text? You know, what kinds of relationships do they generate with one another? What themes are emerging? How should I organize the contents? I had about, you know, maybe 700,000 content lists. and if I tidy it up and integrate it too much, will I lose some of the energy that comes from juxtaposing all these unlikely stories? So all of this was completely new to me, right? It was a new way of writing for me, at least. And it felt much more like I was assembling an archive, which is why I use that term, rather than writing a narrative in chapters in other stuff that I've produced before. So just the last thing I'd say is that what would be great, I suppose, would be if this kind of model of writing, which, as I show in the book, has a very long history in writing on cities, right? You know, there are loads of books that write in fragments. But my hope would be that maybe it would motivate others to do something similar. So, you know, how can I put this? I think we can be fairly conventional in how we write in geography and urban studies. And I'm not saying that what I've done is radically different or new, right? In many ways, actually, this book sticks to all kinds of conventions. And I'm not saying either that conventional is bad, right? There's a reason why people use those conventions time and time and again when they write. It's because they work, right? Those conventions work. But I do often think that, I mean, I just think about conversations I've had with friends all over the place who work on cities who've kind of said to me that they would like to try writing differently. They'd like to try writing this paper or this book in a different way, but they don't really know, they just don't get around to doing it, right? For all kinds of reasons, you know. I don't think there's any one particular reason, right? There's a whole bunch of personal and individual reasons as to why people don't do it. But I sort of hear people talk about writing differently and then not feeling they can. So I guess, you know, in answer to what you were saying, I'd hope that the book, I'm not sure it expands our understanding of archival writing, but I'd hope that it would maybe motivate people, if they were thinking of experimenting slightly differently, to try to do that, if only because they were like, well, now I can see how not to do it. I'll do it properly. He's made such a pig's ear of it, yeah.
I mean, I personally found it motivating. and I love that, you know, fragments isn't just an argument, but it's a genre in the book. I found that so refreshing.
Right. So you, at least it's one person then.
if that helps. Yeah, so in another part, you focus on walking as a method. And I love this sentence you use, which is, one of the most important ways in which we learn about cities is by moving through them. And, you know, I particularly found it interesting that you use movement comparatively across New York, Berlin, and Hong Kong, for example. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on walking as a method and possibly a comparative one.
Yeah, that's really, thanks for raising that, because we haven't really discussed walking, but there is a whole section in the book on walking, and it sort of emerged later in the process of writing the book. Part of it was a realization that walking is just so important to how I think about cities. You know, even before I was an academic, or even, you know, wherever I go, you know, pre-pandemic times when we could travel a lot more, that, you know, it would be through walking that I came to get a feel for a place, however partial, however situated, however limited that feel for that place might be. You know, it was on foot, moving through the city, that really made sense to me as something that I really wanted to do, and to kind of get at least, yeah, just a feel for how things work and how things are. You know, the smells and the sights and the noises and the, you know, the kind of rhythms and the ebbs and flows of people and the architectural mismatch that makes up cities and all that kind of stuff is just so viscerally available when you're walking. In a way that, you know, okay, a great book might do some of that work, but there's nothing quite like sort of being immersed sensorially in the rhythm of a city. So partly it was a realization, you know, why do I not write more about that if it's so fundamental, right? If it's so fundamental to how I make sense of cities, why don't I sort of fess up and say that a bit more often in my work? And also, like, talking to colleagues, it's pretty clear that it's true for many urbanists. So I got interested in thinking about walking and about how people move through cities. And of course, there's all kinds of ways in which people move through cities. And, you know, there's a large, really interesting literature, for example, in disability studies about different forms of mobility in the city. There's a large feminist literature on walking in cities, given that most of the history of the kind of, you know, the work that's been written about walking has been largely written by white men, and is, you know, who have very particular encounters and who have certain doors opened and certain opportunities and certain capacities to move and be in the city that might be harder or more difficult or even denied to other subject positions. So I got very interested in thinking a lot about this and asking myself, well, to what extent did the way I walk around these different cities that I've been working in, you know, impact how I see fragment urbanism in those different places? So that's one of the questions I was asking myself in the writing. And I thought, in the end, I thought this really deserves its own section in the book because I've been thinking about it so much. And I think what walking does in brief is that it gives you some insight into the life of fragments in situ, right? You know, in a neighborhood, in different parts of the city, you can see fragments, you know, of stuff of different kinds, whether it's buildings or objects or discarded things or art projects, whatever it might be. You can see it in situ in the rhythms of the city. And you can see people encounter them. You can see people respond and react to them. You can see how they disrupt urban flows or enable them, how they become magnets or how they drive people away, how they become sources of confusion or interest, you know, fragments of, you know, bits of infrastructure that maybe no one knows why they were built or what they're there for or what they even are, you know, all kinds of interesting stories that sort of, like, you know, might become attached to them. And you can sort of see that. So it gives you a feel for how fragments surface, but it's a very speculative kind of encounter with fragments because, as I was just intimating, it promotes more questions than answers because you're watching these kind of encounters and you're encountering fragments yourself whilst also wondering, well, what's the story here? Where did this thing come from? You know, why are those people using it in these ways? What's the history of this? What's its politics? And also, what are the fragments I'm not seeing, right? I'm on foot walking through streets. I'm not looking into buildings. I'm not looking into houses. I'm not seeing certain neighborhoods or parts of the city because every route has its limits. So you're wondering what you're not seeing as well as what you are seeing. So it's a very kind of speculative encounter, which means that you're always having to supplement it with something else, right? Whether that's research methods like interviews or ethnography or data that you gather from secondary materials or whatever, or by spending the kind of time of living and embedding yourself in a place that, so that you can gather a kind of greater depth through everyday life around those fragments. So in other words, walking is both about the route and about its limits. That's very important. But then this last thing I'd say about comparison. So because I didn't do a comparative research project on walking and fragments, but I was moving between different research projects and doing these walks and thinking about fragments and then finding that other cities were pressing in on my imagination quite a lot. So you might be walking down a street in Berlin or New York and think, I wonder if, the arts festival I saw in Hong Kong or the food market I saw in Hong Kong would work somewhere like this. That's a very trivial example. But in a sense, the kind of presence of other cities provokes questions about the city you're walking through. And you notice that, actually the kind of fragments you might see in one neighborhood, even within one city like New York, are very different, right, from the fragments you might see in different neighborhoods and between cities as well. So, walking around Berlin, for example, which I discuss in the book, you can see in some neighborhoods, infrastructure, housing, buildings, discarded materials, fragmented things, basically, that don't exist in the much more tidied up, heavily invested, heavily policed neighborhoods in other parts of Berlin or and the same for New York, right? You see these, so you can actually start to read almost histories of disinvestment in a minor scale, albeit in a limited way, just by moving through and seeing where the fragments sort of appear and don't appear. So there's a comparative element both within the city as you walk different parts of the city and between cities. That's quite an interesting conversation that goes on. And I think urbanists are doing this all the time, right? There's a conversation that's going on in our heads all the time. Like, urbanists read cities when they go to them in particular kinds of ways, with particular questions and epistemologies and experiences. And those comparisons are always pressing in on us. So we're always having these juxtapositions between many different places. And the same is true of reading fragments in that sense.
Indeed. And you mentioned that walking opens up new questions. So lastly, I want to ask, what is next for you? What are some new questions, projects, or even courses that you're working on right now?
Like all of us, a lot of the work that I've been doing is stalled, because we can't go anywhere, or it's hard. We're starting to travel. I mean, I've been doing bits of field work online and offline in different places, in different projects. But I'm looking forward to getting back to actually traveling. So a lot of my time at the moment is spent thinking about density and crowds. And this is to do with a research project funded by the European Research Council, which looks at urban densities. And really the question is, how is density experienced and perceived in different parts of the urban world? And we've been doing this project for a couple of years now and in different cities. And of course, COVID-19 became a huge focus of that project because, what did COVID do? It basically put a stop to all kinds of densities, all kinds of crowds in the city. It almost was this kind of great anti-densification pandemic where it was all about getting people out of crowded situations. So the question of the crowd, the question of density is at stake in a way that it hasn't been for many decades, at least going back to, the Spanish flu and the end of World War I, where there's a real question mark about what it means to be in dense urban spaces. So a lot of my thinking is really around that question and that problematic with colleagues in different places. And then the fragments work, I guess, I'm continuing to try to take that work forward in different ways. So thinking about fragments and writing, and the history of writing in fragments as a way of understanding the urban present. But also working with colleagues in ways of taking some of the fragments work forward in new directions. So that's pretty much what I'm up to at the moment, alongside all the other stuff that we have to do.
That's fascinating. We'll be looking forward to what comes out of that work. Thank you very much, Colin, for joining us and for your insights.
No, thank you. It's been real fun to do this and really interesting and to hear your thoughts and reflections. So, yeah, massive thank you to you for taking the time and asking such thoughtful, interesting questions.
It was truly my pleasure. I am Aliza Arjan. This discussion of Fragments of the City, Making and Remaking Urban Worlds, published by the University of California Press in 2021, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.